particular insurance company or the industry as a whole, at this point, I'm not privy to that information. I just don't receive that information.
I think that in terms of trying to respond to constituents, be it the child care providers or small business people or directors and officers of nonprofit organizations, that usually the story they will relate is that either their insurance has been canceled or not renewed, or that the rates have gone up 100%, 200%. The amount of coverage that they were able to get was very much more limited. They were asked to take a larger deductible. The limits came down. And the next question would be, well, what kind of loss experience have you had? And more likely than not, the response would be, we haven't had any losses. We can't understand why we can't get insurance, or why things have happened as they have. I assume you folks have perhaps heard the same thing. How would you how do you respond to those kinds of situations?
Mr. Springer, the concept of insurance, I guess, is to have the many pay for the losses of the few. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I didn't have an automobile loss last year on my personal auto policy, and yet my rate goes up 15%, that 15% is probably paying for my next door neighbor who may have had a $500 claim. So therefore, we're all paying for the expenses of the claims that the few are having, and that's just the concept of insurance. I would like to think that system works. I think generally it does work, but there are, in my case, certain examples that I see on a daily basis that the industry as a whole hasn't been unprofitable, but that industry is being asked to pay for, because the insurance company writes D&O and they also write auto liability, maybe their losses in the D&O end of the business are exorbitant, so they're across the board in all classes raising the insurance rates to the automobile carrier or the automobile policyholder to pay for the losses that they've incurred on the directors and officers policy.
Is it your sense that on the D&O insurance, for example, that coverage is kind of grouped together in terms of profit versus nonprofit organizations?
As far as the insurance carrier, I would say that's true. They essentially underwrite based on profit versus nonprofit. I think that's right.
They do separate the two.
They are separated.
You have carriers that write nonprofit only, and others that write just for profit.
Counsel?
Yeah. Do they also separate it in their reinsurance treaties? I was told by one of the agencies that their, I believe it was Chubb, that their reinsurer did not differentiate between profits and nonprofits, and one of the reasons for the increase in directors and officers insurance was the tender offer takeovers and the large corporate suits that had been going on. Do you have any information about that, or is that incorrect?
Well, I think that's unfortunate. There's some truth in that. They can increase, if a carrier is sustaining large amounts of loss, if you're talking about somebody like the Chubb, for example, who is the exception rather than a rule in the directors and officers liability field, because they're virtually one of the only standard companies. Most of the other carriers are specialty companies that specialize in that. Is that if you have, and insurance companies are not fine people sometimes, but they panic. They've had some real losses. Chubb may not have the ability actuarially on a short-term basis to decide what their experience has been in profit or nonprofit. All they can see is they're losing $2 on every dollar they write. So they tell their underwriters, we need to get $2.50 to $3 for our business now. And in some cases, maybe even worse, because the nonprofits traditionally pay less. Most businesses, I think, relate to people that pay more. There's less risk. Why risk a lot for little? So that's probably another reason why they suffered.
Okay. Thank you.
When you're representing or trying to help folks in Oregon obtain insurance coverage, Is it to your advantage to try to distinguish Oregon from other states in terms of our experience or the things that are different in Oregon that, say, apart from other states?
Certainly, and I think underwriters recognize that. With the exception of the dram shop laws in Oregon, I think the experience, rates for automobile or insurance for all commercial lines basically are much less in Oregon than they are in California, for example. Many insurance carriers shy away from California as a general rule. They just don't want to be there. But certainly being in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, it's a point we do sell often, and the rates reflect that because losses that our experience are put into Oregon has different rates for general liability and automobile than California, Idaho, or Washington. Each one, it's a by-state situation with the exception of products liability.
Representative Hanlon? Counsel?
Could you tell me, did you notice any changes in the underwriting during the hardening and the softening of the cycles? Does underwriting itself change as the cycle changes?
Well, from my standpoint, in the hard market, we were constantly on the road going to see underwriters, on the phone, talking to underwriters, a lot of times just begging to get our foot in the door to talk about a particular client. In the marketplace now, you have the underwriters coming to us asking for business. Some underwriters are coming and requesting an opportunity to quote an account this year that last year they weren't interested in. So but that's not across the board again. That's, you know, depending on certain classes of business. There are still those that are difficult accounts.
So then the underwriting standards sort of follow the market. If there's capacity, the underwriting standards may be looser. If there's no capacity, they may be a lot tighter.
Exactly.
Is that
sure? Well, if the insurance carrier is making a profit, their attitude is they, of course, like to make more of a profit, so they, at this point, they'd like to write more of the business.
So they may be insuring risks in one stage of the market that they would not be insuring in another stage of the market.
I think that's correct.
Okay. Another question. During the hard market, did you see any withdrawal of whole lines of insurance that resulted in cancellation to individuals of their policies midterm? For example, if for all of liquor liability, for example, moved out of the state, were any bars or taverns actually canceled mid-policy? Or do they just wait and phase out and honor the policies that are already in effect?
You mean somebody say, for example, that you've got a daycare center renewal comes up and say we don't do daycares anymore, so you don't have insurance?
Not for non-renewal, but where it results in an actual cancellation
midterm
because the line of insurance or the company has moved out.
Certainly.
That does happen. Okay, thank you.
Unfortunately.
I think, if I might interrupt, it's not unusual for an underwriter to call you up and ask to be relieved of a particular account for whatever reason, and then it's our charge to find a new underwriter to write the business. I'm sure Dennis would say we like to do the job for our client, convince the underwriter that stay on the account until natural expiration, and we will replace it at that time. And normally on a case-by-case basis, we'll negotiate for the, you know, certain terms to give us 90 days or 60 days or wait till natural renewal. But it's not uncommon for an underwriter, either in the hard market or the soft market, to ask to be relieved midterm on a particular account.
You asked about a class of business, and Roger's right. We do have some leverage with the insurance carriers where if we have a trucker, for example, that and a company decides they want to write truckers anymore, and that's a good example, we're able to say to them that we have substantial business with you. This is our client. It's been our client for a lot of years. They've been loyal. We would ask that you stay on as a agency accommodation. At that point, we're able to get things done. But there were some pretty large losses in Pacific Lines sometimes. Most of the time is due to underpricing and not anything to do with the actual risk itself.
How many days, if you do get a midterm cancellation, what is a reasonable period of time for you to expect to have notice in order to book it with someone else? Can you do it in a day, 10 days, 20 days?
It depends on the risk. If you're looking at something that's really volatile and companies you have people coming out of an area of insurance and somebody else willing to do it, chances are a lot of people are coming out of it and just one or two are staying in it, so they're backlogged quite a bit. Over the last few years, I can honestly say that we have not had any situations where the companies put us in a position where we couldn't replace coverage if it was available. The time frame didn't have a lot to do with it. Nobody said 5 days or 10 days.
Okay. Even during the hard market, that was time was not the issue.
In my experience, it was not, personal experience.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you folks tend to go to the same sources for insurance for your clients, the people you represent?
I think so. We try to find the better one quicker than competitors, but for the most part, yes.
Both admitted companies and foreign companies and the surplus lines and reinsurers, you generally would be working with the same sources.
Yes.
Generally speaking.
Further questions?
Yeah.
Representative Hanlon.
As a broker or performing that function within this state, and writing a policy for a daycare center, how much do you get?
Another thing about the hard market and soft market, and I can assure you that we get a lot less percentage commission in the hard market. Probably, as an overall basis, brokers and insurance agents will do better financially in the hard market. We work a lot harder, but not as much as you'd think. Where we get 15% on the same umbrella policy for Main Street business, I've seen as little as 1.5% and 2% over the last couple of years. We don't thrive on the despair of our clients.
And that stays at a flat percentage over the years of the policy?
Correct. Generally speaking.
Generally speaking, the policies are all one-year policies, and the commission, in this case, if it's 5%, is 5% for that 1 year. And to be negotiated either up or down at the renewal.
Thank you.
Council?
Did I understand? Do your commissions change as the market changes? Is that part of the competitive part of the cycle? So in a hard to get, your commissions will be lower, and you're working a lot harder. And in a soft market, your commissions go up. So it's kind of counter. Okay.
Two reasons for that. One, with the standard companies, you'll see them say that if they're going to increase the premium 50%, there's no reason why we should be rewarded for that. So they and the standard companies reduce their premiums, their commission rates quite a bit. And in the surplus lines market, basically the attitude is you're lucky to have us. You'll take whatever we're willing to pay you. And we do.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, if not, thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate you coming down this evening. Information's been most helpful. And I don't know if you have any written materials you'd like to share with us, or I'll leave that to you and your discretion. Unfortunately, we had a couple of members who couldn't be with us tonight. If you do have any additional written comments you'd like to share with us, we'd be glad to distribute those to all committee members. And again, we thank you for your participation this evening.
Representative Springer, I'd just like to make one statement. Dealing with underwriters on a day-to-day basis, I get the opinion or the impression that primary in their concern is to reduce or to keep a loss from occurring, to keep an insured from having the loss. And once that loss occurs, then the concern is to of course reduce the expenses and reduce the possible payout. So I think most of the underwriters I deal with, their primary concern is to limit the number of losses to prevent losses is primary. And then the secondary concern, of course, is once the loss has occurred, they'd like to reduce the amount of payout that they would have to pay. So whether it be Dennis and I sat for an hour on the concern for collateral source, another concern is the joint and several liability. So just like that, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Well, just to ask you on that, Roger, I
think I understood both of you earlier to say you're a bit wary about the commissioner coming in and rather than filing use, especially where there are major increases, to turn around and have to have a pre-approval before the rate could go into effect. Would it be fair to say that you're both proponents of the supply and demand, basically the free market with as little government interference as possible?
Well, I think that's a fair statement. I think the gist of what we're talking about today is the insurance reform. In a free market system, I think you're going to have a hard time telling insurance companies in Oregon only that they are going to write this business, because if they think they're going to lose a lot of money, they're going to bolt. I think the key to tort reform, and again, Mr. Hamlin, I don't think it's on a short-term basis.
Did you say court reform?
Tort reform, I'm sorry. Tort reform.
We're talking about the civil justice system.
Yes. Okay. I guess my point there is on the long-term basis, I really believe that it's losses that insurance companies experience that determine rates. Unfortunately, not on a short-term basis, but on a long-term basis. So.
But you think there should be some government regulation in the courts on more control on the system that exists in the courts, but not in the insurance area. Would that be fair?
Well, not altogether. We have quite a bit of regulation insurance area at this point on a state level, not on a federal level so much. As far as tort reform, I think that's a selective thing. There are areas where, in my personal opinion, things aren't equitable, and there are other areas where certainly there's no need of improvement.
Things are what?
May not be equitable in certain areas. In other areas, certainly if somebody's injured, they should be entitled to be compensed for any losses that they've experienced, as well as damage to pain and suffering. Question of mine there.
Any loss, they should be compensed for any losses, include as well as damages for pain and suffering. Okay, yeah. And so I understand what you said.
Sure.
Yeah, I agree with you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? If not, thank you again, gentlemen, very much. Appreciate
you
coming down.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We're going to take a short break for staff primarily and be back. Please, let's try to make it about 5 till 8, and then we'll proceed with the balance of our program this evening. I'd like to continue with our invited testimony this evening with Mr. Wendell Gronso. And though Senate Bill 325 didn't quite make it across the floor, it's my understanding that we're going to hand out copies, that it lives again in another bill, perhaps identified as Senate Bill 222. So I think the issues that Mr. Gronso is going to discuss with us this evening as it relates to changes perhaps in the legal system and how it is we handle litigation in this state will be very much before us in one form or another. And
I have a few copies, and I'm not very proud of them. I actually got off the top of my head this morning.
I'm glad to share those numbers. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you'd like to introduce yourself, I would let members know that it is my privilege to serve with Mr. Gronso on the interim task force, and he came a long distance and served with us regularly at no reimbursement whatsoever and contributed greatly to our efforts, and I'm very pleased he can join us tonight. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Chairman Springer and members of the committee. My name is Wendell Gronso. I'm a country lawyer from Burns, Oregon, and I practice in and around Burns. In case you don't know where Burns is, I heard on the radio coming through Bend today that Bend was in the middle of nowhere. The radio announcer was announcing that, and if Bend is in the middle of nowhere, Burns is on the outer edges of nowhere. Yeah, a little bit. And I am probably, you call me a trial lawyer, that's about all I do is try cases and prepare for cases. And the cases that I handle are primarily in the tort field. My practice is just about equally divided between representing plaintiffs and representing defendants. And as Representative Springer has told you, I did have the privilege of serving on the legislative task force that looked into the whole matter of the liability insurance in the state of Oregon. And I had the privilege of hearing all of the testimony that was presented to that committee. And one of the questions that was bothering me, and I only got an answer from one carrier, and the question that I continually ask was, how much are you paying out in defense costs? In other words, how much is this system really costing us? How much is of these insurance premiums are going to the cost of litigation? And the companies continually came in with the figures, and they were showing us that the policies had cost them X dollars, and they lumped together defense cost and payouts. One company, Farmers Insurance Group, did bring in the figures. They brought in the figures on their hospital liability insurance for the years 1975 through 1985 inclusive. And we discovered from their figures that for every dollar paid out to claimants, they had spent 63 cents on defense costs. Now, it doesn't take very much ingenuity to figure out there's something wrong with the cost of our system when it's costing that kind of money. And that's insurance company defense cost is coming right off the top, coming right out of the premium dollar. I remember sitting in on a meeting of defense counsel about 25 years ago when a claims manager for a large insurance company chided the defense lawyers because that company was paying out 8% on the premium dollar for defense cost. And we didn't have much luck on the task force, but I will bet you it's up over 30-35% of their out-of-pocket cost is. Tied up in defense costs. And I've got firsthand knowledge of how all this happened. I've been trying cases in the state of Oregon since 1949, and I've seen the enormous amount of extra work that's been heaped upon the trial lawyer. The first case that I tried in Oregon was a things were simple in those days. You had one plaintiff and one defendant in most cases. You filed your complaint, maybe took a deposition, went in and tried the case. And coming along sometime in the 1960s, and I can't even pinpoint it when it happened, the legislature decided at the urging of some defense lawyers that we should start following the federal rules. Now, the federal rules have always had all this paper chase in them. The federal courts, though, primarily are dealing with larger cases and a different type case than we try in Oregon. We started getting things in like more discovery, letting each other rummage through each other's files, requests for admissions, third-party practice, motions for summary judgments, and the paper chase just kept piling up on us and piling up. And finally, we discovered that we're spending twice the amount of time on the same case that we did before all this came to pass. And the horrible part of it is, as I look back over the 38 years that I've been trying cases, I cannot honestly say that the outcome of any one of those cases that I tried before and after are any different because of all these keen new tools they've given us, and we have to use them. because we'd probably be guilty of malpractice if we didn't make the other guy jump through every hoop that came down the pike, and that goes for plaintiff's cases and defendants. And this was brought on first by the legislature, passed a few rules. Then the legislature passed the bill making the council and court procedures. I was on that council and court procedures the first 6 years, and I watched it snowball. And I preached then to the other members of the council and court procedures that we are going to price ourselves right out of business. And that's exactly what's happened. And the courts have increased the cost of doing business by them widening out some of the discovery and that type thing. Now, one of the biggest culprits is third-party practice. And as I didn't realize till I got down here that this bill had not passed the Senate as yet. And I urge the passage of a bill similar to at least Senate Bill 325 with one exception, and that is to add every, except in cases of contribution, and add or indemnity. And I'd like to take a few minutes. Does everybody in the committee know what third-party practice is? Maybe I should. Okay. Third-party practice is just this. Three-car accident. I'm the plaintiff. I'm injured. Two other motor vehicles involved. I saw it all happen. I'm convinced that A car was the car that did all of the damage. B car, in my opinion, was completely faultless. So I sue A car. But instead of me going to trial against A car, now when I have third-party practice, the A car lawyer says, well, I want some company here. So he files a third-party complaint against B car saying, I want contribution or indemnity, usually contribution, from A car. And then I decided, then A car says, and I don't think that intersection was so good. I think maybe they failed to put a stop sign in the proper place. So a third party's in the state of Oregon. And then you can go on the state of Oregon, third party's in the contractor that was supposed to put the stop sign up. And the first thing you know, instead of having two lawyers, you've got 8 or 10 lawyers. And the paperwork starts to flow. And then the next step, and it's just a real practical step, and the people usually passing these laws are sitting here before you have looked at it and say, well, this is Keene doing this, but they don't look at the practical end. You get 4 or 5 busy trial lawyers and just try to get find a day for a deposition when somebody hasn't got a trial off in Timbuktu. And the case, and it just goes on and on and on, and each lawyer, each of these defendants is paying, is running up $5,000-$10,000 defense cost. I have a case pending right now, and it happens to be in the state of Nevada, but Nevada has the same rules as we have that I'd like to see it get rid of. I represent a little electric cooperative. We built, or it built, some power lines, built about 70 miles of power lines, and hired an engineer. And the engineer was supposed to draw plans and specifications and supervise the job and inspect everything and make sure that it was done. Well, we ended up with a bunch of faulty cross arms, and a couple of years after the line was built, it started dropping 115,000 bolts in the ground here and there when a cross arm had shed. So we sued the engineer, and he had sole contract with us. And it should have, and under the old system, we would have had a lawsuit against him And if we won, then maybe he had a right to go after somebody else for indemnity or contribution. But no, he immediately filed a third-party complaint against the inspection service that we didn't even know was involved, that he had hired to look at the cross arms. He filed a third-party complaint against the contractor claiming that the contractor had furnished the faulty materials. He filed a third-party complaint against two suppliers of the cross arms and against two manufacturers of the cross arms. So all of a sudden, instead of two lawyers and two defendants, we had six defendants and seven lawyers. And we go on and on and on. And then the horrible part of it is, if we lose the initial case against the engineer, all of that is for naught. Under the old system, the defendant, if somebody else was partially at fault or completely at fault, the defendant could put the other party on notice that if I lose this case, then I'm going to sue you. But now we bring the whole kit and caboodle in and we just spend money hand over fist. The defense cost, I would like to know what total defense costs are in the industry as a whole, but for some reason,